This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. During the 9/11 Commission's hearing on emergency response, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani said that in the chaos and shock of crisis, mistakes are inevitable.
Catastrophic emergencies and attacks have acts of great heroism attached to them. They have acts of ingenious creativity attached to them, and they have mistakes that happen. Hopefully this commission will assess that correctly with compassion and with understanding. And then the next one will be done a little bit better. But the next one, unfortunately, is probably going to be a mix of exactly those same things. Acts of great heroism, many, many creative and brilliant things done, and some terrible mistakes that were made. Because when human beings are put under this condition, that's what happens.
The report by the 9/11 Commission did recognize the heroism of thousands of first responders and lauded them for their efforts. But it also said that future mistakes could and should be minimized with better planning, better technology, better training, and a clear chain of command. The report said problems of emergency preparedness are not confined to uniform services. The private sector needs to get involved, too, and that all of this applies not just to New York or the Washington, D.C. area, but nationwide. Later in the program, a modest proposal for presidential term limits in the Arab world. But first, the third in the series on the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. A look today at first responders. If you're a police officer, firefighter, 9/11 operator, give us a call. What changes need to be made? And if you work in the private sector, has your company made plans for emergencies? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Philip Zelikow is the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He joins us now by phone from his office in Virginia. Good to have you back on the program.
Glad to be back.
Now, one of the extraordinary things about rereading the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission in this regard was the conclusion that almost inevitably, when there is another incident, the first responders are likely to be civilians.
That's right, because the first people to react are going to be the people in the buildings. And nearly 90% of all the critical buildings in this country are owned by private firms. So private firms are basically going to drive what happens in the first minutes after a catastrophe, well before the fire, police, and other emergency services people get there.
When you're talking about firefighters, police officers, there's obviously things government can do. Congress can mandate, city and state legislatures can draw up laws. What about the private sector?
Well, the private sector needs to get people ready for what they're going to do in a catastrophe. They need to think through, do we have a building that's vulnerable? If we have a building, what are our plans? And we mapped out in the report some simple questions that building owners and major tenants can ask themselves to figure out whether they're ready. And fortunately, working with the commission, the American National Standards Institute has actually promulgated some standards to help guide private firms in what they can do to be sure they're ready, because a lot of lives, well, at least some lives, were lost because people didn't know what they were supposed to do.
So people who work for companies, presidents, chairmen of boards, that sort of thing, everybody should be asking their company if they've made these plans.
Right, and let me underscore that for not only chairmen of boards, but members of boards. I think it's an important part of responsible corporate governance for people who are members of boards of directors to be sure that their companies are prepared for bad things to happen,
and
including their ability to rebound from a catastrophe and continue corporate operations, which was something we looked at a little bit.
And a lot of companies that were headquartered in the World Trade Center devastated by that.
Some were, and then some were not. That was one of the revealing things. We found that some companies that had made good preparations really benefited from that. Companies that got every single one of their employees out and that had a plan for continuity of operations. It was good for the country and it was good for the companies that they were ready, and we want to learn from the good examples.
And there was also a proposal for some sort of indirect compliance enforcement by asking insurance companies to consider whether the people they're insuring have complied with all of these suggestions.
Right, in the same way that an insurance company would look to whether you've complied with building codes and fire codes, we think emergency preparedness is a part of the preparations to minimize losses, and insurance companies are entitled to ask people whether they've minimized losses, especially if they're seeking federal terrorism insurance, if they're looking for the government to be their backer in securing their claims. The government is entitled to ask whether the people seeking such insurance have done their part.
One of the critical elements that the report concluded in terms of the uniformed people responding, I think Vice Chairman Lee Hamilton put it best when he asked the question, who's in charge when you have a number of primary agencies at the scene?
Yes, and that was a problem in New York City. It's uncertain whether that problem costs lives or not. There's a lively argument about that. But there's no argument at all about the fact that a clear incident command system is better. The Pentagon, for instance, the response to the jet that hit the Pentagon was greatly aided by the good incident command system that had been worked out among a lot of different responding authorities from both Northern Virginia and the District of Columbia. It worked well, and again, where you see things that work, let's learn from the good examples.
The other general area, and we're going to take some calls in just a moment, but the other general area that you talk about is communications and, well, also culture, that none of these agencies necessarily want to, everybody wants to be in charge.
Well, that's true, which is one reason why you need a strong incident command system that takes responsibility for communications without relying on all the different components to be sure they're doing it all. One other aspect of communications I'd like to highlight for you are 911 operators. We found that one of the big problems here is that the 911 operators were really the people who were giving advice to folks inside the buildings. Yet the 911 operators weren't really part of the command system. They hadn't gotten clear guidance on what was going on in the buildings. They didn't really know what was going on and weren't told clearly what to say. The 911 operators need to be thought of as part of the team because they, in many ways, are giving more important information than anybody else is. They could have saved a number of additional lives if they had given people, if they had known what people on the scene knew.
Now let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our number again, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Anthony, who's with us on the line from San Francisco.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
You know, I had a comment with regards to the fatalities in New York, and I was reading a study, and it was actually several hundred pages with regards to what happened. And it pretty much said exactly what you had just commented on. If there were a better chain of command, a solidified one, and better incident command system, I hate to sound sacrilegious, but there would be a lot less fatalities. And I honestly think that one thing that should be focused upon is more training and better ICS. Like you said, the incident command system, that's like drilled into our heads here in California, and it seems to work fairly well. But, you know, in the end, it's all about money.
And are you involved in emergency services there in San Francisco?
Yes, sir. I work on a private ambulance.
Okay. Philip Zelico, I think part of the problem that emerged at the hearings was this perception that clearly everybody lauds the bravery. Nobody questions the courage of the men and women who responded to those terrible accidents. And everybody knows that the blame lies with the 19 people who hijacked those aircraft.
Well, Mayor Giuliani has expressed that very well. Of course, the people who are responsible for these deaths ultimately are the killers. But it's still our job to do what we can to mitigate their damage.
And the points that Anthony's making about training. Do you do training, Anthony, in San Francisco with the various services?
You know, our private ambulance company does it. When I was going to school, the county ambulance company, they did, and they coordinated police, fire, and EMS all together. Now, I know that that's specific here to the Bay Area in California, and there's a lot of training, and a lot of the focus, especially in the last 3 years, has been placed on weapons of mass destruction drills and mass casualty incident drills. And even in a simple training incident, you could see where things could go wrong.
Well, thank you for the call, Anthony. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Here's an email we have from Michael McGuire in Vancouver, Washington. Understandably, he writes, the discussion refers to disasters similar to the 9/11 attack. In the news, the Russian school and several hundred people have been taken hostage, reportedly by suicide bombers, just like the 9/11 attack. This is something that here in America would catch us pretty much by surprise. My question is, are there plans to respond to an attack similar to the Russian school situation, and how would the 9/11 Commission's report help deal with that happening?
Well, the simple answer is you can't have a plan for every conceivable situation. What you instead think about is build capabilities. If your capabilities are strong and flexible and you've got a good command system, then you've got things that can respond to a lot of different problems. If you have a capability, so do we have a capability to mobilize police, National Guard, fire, hazmat protection, public health people? And do we know how to coordinate the use of those capabilities? If the answer to that is yes, you can adapt a lot of that to the problem that you have at hand if you've got good capabilities and good command.
And how does the command be adaptable? Obviously, the 9/11 situation, all you needed to do was look up in the buildings. It's a fire. Should the fire department have command then?
Well, the problem in New York City was that each responding agency had its own command system, making decisions for its own people. But there wasn't a good integration of command between the fire department, the NYPD, the New York Police Department, and the Port Authority of New York Police, who were also among the major responders that coordinated what all of them were doing and made sure that they all had good situation awareness. We found that the police sometimes knew things that the senior fire chiefs on the scene did not know, and vice versa. There needs to be good common situation awareness, and you shouldn't rely on all of them to be sure they're talking to each other. There ought to be an incident command in charge to be accountable for having situation awareness and being sure that's communicated, because the responders themselves are too busy doing their own jobs.
Let's talk now with Rob in Paducah, Kentucky.
I've got my father is a firefighter and a paramedic in Houston, Texas, and they have been running into several problems as far as being understaffed, and I know that they've just recently had a new mayor come in and take over, but the problems left over from the old mayor, Mayor Brown, were that they would not put more than three firefighters per truck. And they had a few deaths resulting from being understaffed.
Yep.
I think they were doing it to keep the budget down, or because they kept claiming that they had no budget, but they were spending money in other areas that clearly didn't need to be spent.
Well, Philip Zelico, whether it's that particular situation or dozens of others, money is at the heart of a lot of this.
Well, of course, money is important, because now we're asking people all over America to build these extraordinary capabilities for responding to emergencies. And we really say two things about that. First is, you've got to pool your resources in your county and your region. You can't expect every single town and every single county to duplicate all these capabilities. We just don't have that much money. You've got to pool your capabilities and then have an incident command system that can bring them together for an emergency. That's one. Two, you've got to get federal aid to the people who need it most. These are going to be attacks on the United States as a whole. They're just going to happen to fall on one particular community. That community is entitled to get federal help in preparing for that. But we argued very strongly that the federal help should be allocated based on purely on the merits, on risk and vulnerability.
Philip,
we're
going to have to pick this up after the break, Philip. Sorry. We'll have more on the question of emergency preparedness after a short break. It's NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about first responders and the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission on how to best prepare for emergencies in your city, your suburb, your neighborhood. If you're an emergency responder, give us a call. We want to hear what changes you've made in your emergency plans, what changes you're considering. And again, this refers to the private sector as well. What has your company done? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. We're speaking with Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. Just before the break, I'm sorry I had to cut you off, but you were making an important point about the allocation of Homeland Security funds.
It was just a simple point that it ought to be allocated on the merits and not based on politics or the need to be sure that everybody gets a piece of the pie. Some people really do need much more support than other people do. Some communities are much more at risk than other communities are. It's true the terrorists might strike someplace that no one would think of, but unfortunately you've got to make hard choices about how you spend your money. And it's clear that places, for instance, like New York City and Washington, D.C., are entitled to more than their share.
Joining us now is Jerry Hauer, former director of the New York City Office of Emergency Management. He's currently the executive director of the Response to Emergencies and Disasters Institute. He's also a professor at the George Washington University, and he's with us by phone from New York City. Good of you to be with us today.
Good to be with you.
You said in your testimony to the 9/11 Commission that much had been done to prepare New York. You said it was probably the best prepared city in the country, but that there was much work left to do. Is that still the case, and what's the scope of major work that remains to be done?
Well, I think that New York had been and continues to be the city that continues to look at cutting edge in everything that goes on. I think, though, that one of the issues that has plagued the city for many, many years is the issue of incident command. And while we had an incident command system in place during the mayor's term, the current system has taken a step backwards in the way incident command is managed here in the city.
Taken a step backwards in what way?
Well, there is less definition in who is in charge in many of the incidents in the city. There is a fundamental problem here in New York that very few, if any, cities in the country face. You have two agencies doing the same job, and that has created a conflict for many, many years. The police department has a specialized unit that does building collapse, hazardous materials, high-angle rescue, that few, if any, police departments in the country do. So they are in direct conflict on many of these issues. There is a redundancy with the fire department, and that has set up the basis for much of the friction that goes on between the two departments at some of these bigger incidents.
Philip Zelikow, I wanted to ask you, the 9/11 Commission report speaks specifically of this. Well, it's a cultural issue. There have been reports of, fistfights at some times between cops and firefighters.
Yes, there have been. We've heard stories about that sort of thing. There are a few things we heard about, too. One witness reported an NYPD emergency services unit officer was evacuating. He'd received the order to evacuate. He told firefighters they better get out. It was his impression that the firefighters didn't want to take orders from cops. Firefighters who didn't get out died.
I think this is where the commission really missed and failed to understand what went on that day, in that there is no question in most of the people's minds here in New York that are involved in emergency services that in spite of the fact that some of the firefighters heard the evacuation order, they were not going to leave the building unless they had gotten out, their fellow firefighters and the civilians. I think that some of the conflict on that day that the commission talked about was overstated. In fact, the police did what they were supposed to do. The police least recognized it as a fire, and they set up to control traffic. The emergency service went in to help with evacuations. The aviation unit was up in the air evaluating the building. But the fire department was in charge. They were the lead agency. Clearly, OEM did not coordinate that well that day. OEM
was, Office of Emergency Management.
Right, was not as strong in coordinating and getting them to coordinate that day, and that was a significant mistake on the part of OEM. But at the end of the day, this was an event that, as you heard earlier, you cannot plan for every type of event. New York City has dealt with multi-casualty incidents, with many types of incidents that no other city in the world has dealt with. Mm. But to look at this in perspective, you had a building that was hit, then a second building that was hit. The buildings were basically transected. And by all accounts, anybody above where those planes hit the building was not going to get out. They were cut off from escape routes by and large. It was the people down below that were salvageable. And in some instances, they got out. I agree. The 911 operators, we saw this in the first World Trade Center bombing. The news media during that bombing, one of the weathermen got on, told people to break windows. Last thing that we needed them to do, the communication to the people in the building was difficult. But part of the problem was, again, the infrastructure of the building, because of the catastrophic nature of the event, was cut off. Firefighting water in the upper floors, emergency lighting. The building was transected by the aircraft. So much of the infrastructure of the building was pretty much shut down.
Let's get another caller on the line. Robert is with us from East Hampton, New York.
Hey, how you doing, guys? Great discussion.
Thank you.
I'm an EMT attached to a volunteer fire department out here. And, you know, I have no problem at all with the county and the state and the support we get from them. Of course, you know, we could get materials and supplies a little quicker. But what I wanted to talk about was the training. We train quite a bit out here. We train each unit. We have an ambulance, two ambulances that are attached to the fire department. We'll train with by ourselves, but the best training that we do is when we train with PD and we train with the fire department. And all three of us get together. And, you know, you can go over scenario after scenario after scenario, but, you know, when it comes down to it, the one that you get that's the real one is a little bit different. Each one's a little unique. So if you get a chance to train with the fire department and with the police department and with EMS all together, everybody knows what everybody's supposed to do, and the lines of communication work much better that way.
Jerry Hauer, one of the criticisms, not enough cross-training in New York.
Well, there was cross-training, but there was clearly not enough. And it was a constant struggle to get the two departments to try and train together. We did a number of drills. We did tabletop exercises every 4 to 8 weeks. We did planning meetings almost every other day, working on various types of plans. And all the agencies were at the table. All of them were involved in all the planning. But there was resistance, particularly from the police commissioner and the deputy police commissioner, resistance to sign off on anything that did not put the police department in charge.
Robert, thank you. I appreciate the phone call.
You're welcome.
And Jerry Hauer, we thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Jerry Hauer is former director of the New York City Office of Emergency Management. He's currently executive director of the Response to Emergencies and Disasters Institute and a professor at George Washington University, and he is with us by phone from New York. Joining us now to address how Congress is responding to the 9/11 Commission's recommendations on first responders is Jane Harman, Democrat from California, the ranking member of the House Select Committee on, a member of the House Select Committee on Homeland Security and the ranking member on the Intelligence Committee. She's with us by phone from her office here in Washington. Welcome back to the program. Good to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
Your committee released a report in April saying police, fire, and emergency agencies have received less than 20% of the $6.3 billion in federal anti-terrorism preparedness funds awarded to them. How come?
Well, it's not just the delay in getting the funds out. It's the funding formulas themselves. Congress has been part of the problem. Homeland Security funding is not a revenue-sharing program. It has to be a program that steers all of the funds, not part of the funds, all of the funds to where the vulnerabilities are, and we have not been good at that. So some delays have been in the states transferring money to neighborhoods, but another part of the problem is the funding formulas that we are working with.
And the recommendation by the 9/11 Commission is that, the lion's share of that funding should go to the most vulnerable areas.
They're absolutely right. They've said, and we strongly agree, that the funding should go where the threats and vulnerabilities are. In fact, on the House side, 150 Democrats introduced a bill sometime back to implement a new funding formula that was exactly this, and the House Homeland Security Committee, on a bipartisan basis, reported a bill to do that, but the bill has been stalled in other committees. It is past time that we get the money to where the threats are. As we look at New York bravely keeping its convention safe, and as we looked last month at Boston keeping that convention safe, those first responders, where the threats are the ones who need to get the federal dollars.
Philip Zelikow, I wanted to bring you back in. There is a raft of recommendations that the Commission calls on Congress to act on in this regard. Could you remind us of some of them?
Yes. We asked Congress to set a clear risk and vulnerability criteria for the allocation of federal Homeland Security assistance. We asked Congress to reinforce the mandate that to receive that money, local governments need to have an incident command system that can pass federal muster. We urged Congress to expand the amount of radio spectrum available for emergency services to ease communication. And we suggested that Congress look at whether to find ways, perhaps through federal terrorism insurance, for example, to influence private firms to adopt proper emergency preparedness standards.
Representative Harman, is Congress moving on any of those?
Some of them, but not fast enough. Let me first commend Phil Zelikow, who happens to be an old friend of mine, for a superb job of managing a large staff of an enormously effective commission, which, as we all know, came out with a unanimous report, which is must reading for much of the country. It's very interesting to see how many folks of all kinds are reading this commission report. Congratulations, Phil. With respect to the things he just mentioned, I've addressed the funding formula.
Yeah.
And I think it's critical that we move on legislation that the House Homeland Security Committee has already reported to change the funding formula. On the issue of radio spectrum, I couldn't agree more. There's a place where I am the principal author or co-author with a Republican, Kurt Weldon of Pennsylvania, who heads the Fire Caucus in the House, of legislation to keep Congress's promise, the promise we made in 1997, 4 years prior to 9/11, was that we would make available dedicated radio spectrum for emergency purposes by the end of 2006. There's a loophole in that promise, and unfortunately, unless we close that loophole, Congress won't keep it. And what matters about this is, I think you were really hearing this from some of the prior conversation I heard, what matters about this is that if we have another catastrophe like New York or the Pentagon, And once again, the firefighters can't talk to the police, and the firefighters can't talk to each other, and they can't talk to the Homeland Security Department. It will be our fault. We should fix this problem. The problem is that broadcasters who occupy a small part of the spectrum don't want to move off. And those broadcasters are being very short-sighted, first of all, because they may get hit with a legislative fix that's more drastic, but second of all, because they live and their families live in the same neighborhoods that will be vulnerable if we don't fix the problem.
We're talking about the 9/11 Commission's recommendations on first responders. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Ron is with us from Dayton, Ohio. Hello, Ron.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air. Yes, good. Go ahead, Ron, please.
Yeah, just a comment. I'm involved with administering some grants from DHS relative to urban search and rescue. And as we try and administer these grants, we're allowed to buy equipment. However, a lot of the training issues that need to go along with that equipment are not being fulfilled. Specifically, urban search and rescue grants are for training are being disallowed at this time, if you will. And it's kind of stunning to us that this would be happening now, considering the last two terrorist incidents in the United States were both based on urban search and rescue.
DHS, of course, the Department of Homeland Security. Congresswoman?
I agree. It is counterintuitive that we're not sending the money to the right places, we're not training the right folks, and we're not requiring, as Phil Zelico just mentioned, that the places that are getting the funds prove that they have the infrastructure that's appropriate to use the funds well. Those are the things we should be doing. Congress is part of the problem because we haven't insisted that the funding formulas be changed. Again, I want to commend the caller for raising this and commend the 9/11 Commission for making the right recommendations.
Okay. Ron, thanks very much for the call. And Jane Harmon, we wanted to thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Jane Harmon is a Democrat from California, a member of the House Select Committee on Homeland Security, and the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. Still with us is Phil Zelico, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. We're going to take a couple of more of your calls and emails on this question when we come back from a short break. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Later, we'll also be talking with Rami Khoury, the editor of the Daily Star, a newspaper that's published in Beirut, about his modest proposal for term limitations for leaders in the Arab world. It's caused something of a ruckus in the Arab world, as you might expect. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about first responders and the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission report. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Philip Zelico. He's executive director of the 9/11 Commission. And let's get another caller on the line. Philippe joins us from New Haven, Connecticut.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Philippe Mstislavski. I was one of the first responders on 9/11 in New York City. I was trained as a registered nurse.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say worked well, what didn't, in terms of, obviously a lot of things didn't work well, but what was the main problem from your point of view?
I was asked to lead a team of three paramedics at just outside of the World Financial Center on Ground Zero, and we stayed there till about 8 o'clock in the morning of the 12th of mm-hmm. September. One thing that I think is of overriding importance is that we were not adequately protected. We didn't have respiratory equipment. We didn't even have respirators to protect ourselves from the particles in the air. And we had no communication with the staging ground, with the emergency response officials that sent us to establish the triage outpost. Mm-hmm. So I think the critical thing would be to err on the side of caution in situations like the one that happened in New York, and equip all the responders with respiratory equipment, at least respirators, and In addition to that, food was a problem. For several hours, we didn't have water nor food, and only about 2 o'clock in the morning, on the 12th, we got some donuts and water that was available to us. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to function efficiently in a situation like that without adequate nutrition.
Yes, Philip Zelikow, all of this speaks to planning, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and to the amount of resources and capabilities. It's a valid concern. I think that before 9/11, people didn't understand how dangerous the air quality could become for people who were outside of the immediate incident response zone. I mean, everybody knows that firefighters need to have a respirator, but the air quality issues encountered by the debris on 9/11 were unprecedented and just not something people had imagined. But they are the kinds of issues that would be encountered in some other sorts of catastrophes, say something that involved a release of radiation or certain kinds of public health scenarios also might require protective equipment for all first responders.
Or anything involving chemical or biological attack.
Yeah. And all of these things, of course, are very expensive. If you apply this to all the people who would need such equipment, then you would need to have training and exercises to be sure people were proficient in using it. So that the first time you were trying on the mask wasn't on the day you had to use it to save your life.
Philippe, thank you for that call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Here's an email from Dennis Vogel in Somerset, New Jersey. I heard someone recently remark that the emergency broadcast system was not activated on September the 11th. I don't know how much money is spent on that system, but I do know it's periodically tested on the radio. Do we know why it wasn't used, and who's responsible for that?
I think the caller may be referring to the emergency broadcast system that was developed during the Cold War for civil defense in the cases of nuclear attack.
Or for hurricanes. It was activated last year in Washington when the Hurricane Isabel came through.
The emergency broadcast, that kind of emergency broadcast system was not a relevant factor in communications on September 11th. That wasn't the way that government could most effectively communicate with civilians.
Okay, let's get another caller on the line. Bob is with us from Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Yes, I'm from Johnstown, PA, as you said. I live about 17 miles from where the plane went down in Pennsylvania. I belong to a fire department in that area. We also have EMS. We get a lot of funding from our local government, which I'm thinking we're getting the money, you know, from local, but some local government's getting it from the federal. But we train every Tuesday. It's paid training, certified training. We're trained with our air masks. We're trained to have them on within 1 minute of having the call. Our department's got a lot of new equipment. They call us. Every department in our area call us Little New York. We have 3 different stations just in our area. Our stations are labeled 1, 2, and 3, and that's all of our township. The training and the funding coming from the government has helped us majorly. We don't have the buildings the size of New York, but we do have a lot of sky rises with elderly handicapped people.
Bob, that's encouraging news there in Johnstown. Let me ask Philip Zelikow. We often tend to overlook the fourth airliner that crashed not far from where Bob is. Are there lessons to be drawn from the responders at that site as well?
No, I'm afraid not. I'm afraid not.
All right.
To be brief, it was not an urban impact zone, and the problem was the problem traditionally encountered in air crashes.
Were there problems of communications or command structure there?
The problems were, in many, unfortunately, were no different than the problems encountered whenever an airliner crashes.
Okay.
Mapping the debris field and restricting access to the site and so forth.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate it. Philip Zelikow is the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He's been very kind to join us on several occasions to discuss the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, and our series will continue next week and the week after that as we continue looking into the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission.